Visit our website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. Now, Channel 4 News is one of the best news programmes on television these days, and if you are a fan, you'll probably be familiar with one of its most dedicated reporters, Padraig O'Brien. He's a native of Ballinasloe in County Galway, but over the last few years, he's been at the forefront of some of the most significant news reports on British television, including a very brave expose, I must say, from inside the ranks of the notorious English Defence League. Anyway, Padraig recently travelled to Bucharest in Romania to report on an underworld which many people will be shocked exists in the 21st century. Deep under the streets of Bucharest, there is a network of tunnels and sewers that is home to hundreds of men, women and children stricken by drug abuse, HIV and TB. Now, this brief clip gives a tiny insight into this harrowing existence.
It was a very intense experience. The producer that we had over there, he's a freelance journalist called Radu Chornichuk, great guy. He had made some introductions on our behalf and had started to develop a relationship with the people who live down in the sewers. But when you go down there yourself for the first time, you literally climb down this rickety ladder, you get on your hands and knees, and you start to crawl through the darkness, and you don't really know what to expect. You're not prepared for it. And it's the smell and the sounds and the generator. And then you walk out into this first section of the room called the office. Your eyes adjust to the lighting and you see a really quite hellish sort of scenario. And as you go deeper into the tunnels, the chambers get smaller and smaller and hotter, and they fill up with the fumes of this Arlac. And that has an effect, to be honest with you. I mean, let's just say some of the final pieces to camera that we filmed were unusable.
Now, the Arlac you heard mentioned in that clip is a synthetic paint that addicts sniff as a mild hallucinogenic. It really is frightening stuff. Padraig O'Brien is in the BBC studio in London. Padraig, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Derek.
So we heard a little bit about what it's like down there, and it sounds pretty horrendous. Why did you go down in the first place?
Well, I'm a journalist, and that's what we do, I suppose, is the short answer. The longer answer, that producer, that Romanian producer you heard mentioned in that clip, called Radu, we had done a lot of work with him in Romania over the last few months. And a few months ago, we were sitting having some drinks after a job, and Radu said, "Did you know that there are hundreds of people living under Bucharest from the old Ceausescu orphanages?" And needless to say, our ears pricked up. We sent Radu off over a 2 or 3 weeks to try and reach out to these people and to develop a relationship with them. Radu got us to the point where he felt we should come over to Bucharest, and we arrived in front of the Gare Nord, one of the big train stations in Bucharest, a few weeks ago, and we set and we waited. And later that afternoon, they started to wake up down there, and they started to sort of clamber up out of this hole in the ground in the middle of a traffic island in front of the train station. And when they first come up, these people, like lots of, like obviously endemic long-term drug addiction and problems, but they come up like some, it's like a zombie B movie, also sort of emerging up out of the ground, all disorientated. We met a young boy called Nico, who came up that afternoon. We got talking to this little boy. He looks 12, but it turns out that in fact he's 17 years of age, so stunted is his development by the drugs and abuse. And Nico has got a very close relationship with the man who we will come to, who runs that whole network of tunnels. So we spoke to Nico. We said that I wanted to go down. Nico went back down to send word down to the boss that there was a television crew upstairs, is how they describe it. And a few hours later, word comes back up to us that the boss will see us.
Now, the boss is a guy called Bruce Lee. Am I right in saying that?
Yeah, that's right. That's what everyone knows him as, because he used to be a street fighter in Bucharest, and he's a very, you know, he's like a sort of a punk Fagin, if you like. Mm. He was in the old orphanages himself, an entire sort of childhood institutionalized between the orphanages and the prisons, a very sort of damaged character, as you would imagine, but he's managed to forge this sort of strange twisted community underground. And I mean, I encourage people to try and have a look at the film on our website, because he cuts an almost incredible looking figure. I mean, he's got chains wrapped around his wrists and his ankles. He wears a sort of a leather waistcoat full of medals, and he also that paint that you spoke about, Jack, that silver Aurillac paint that's used in Romania to paint, you know, gates and metallic surfaces, he has that matted into his hair like a helmet. So he is, you know, when you first meet him, it's really jaw-dropping stuff.
And he's the boss down there. So how has he become the boss down there?
Well, that's, I mean, it's a jungle down there, and it's the most, I mean, this guy is not to be messed with. You know, he is as hard as they come. So he's forged his way to the top of the pyramid by the threat of violence and by actual violence. Mm. I mean, the guy's done a lot of time inside. And all the other thing that really struck me about him was, he talks a lot. I mean, you can't get a word in edgeways when he's on one of his rants. But as he's talking, you start to notice that on his arms there's all of this scarring from self-harming in the orphanages. So there's another sort of untold story carved into this man's mm-hmm. arms and stomach. It's quite something, really. But let me just tell you, just to give your listeners a sense of what it's like going down into that hole for the first time. You don't know what to expect. It's a rickety ladder in a hole in a traffic island. You clamber down into along the ladder, then you have to get down on your hands and knees, and you crawl for about maybe a minute or 2 minutes, although it feels longer, and you're kind of potholing into this parallel universe, really. You finally get through the first bit, and you can stand up in a chamber. It's called the office. And in this chamber, there are large sort of central heating ducts that run along the sides. So it's very warm in there. The reason they exist at all is because Ceausescu had this sort of doomed project to centrally heat Bucharest. So he had built this network of tunnels for these vast heating ducts. And now, once you sort of get into that room and you stand up, you see that first room was, I'd say, maybe 50 people in that first room. They're all queuing up to get to the counter. And behind that counter, that's where Bruce Lee is. And on that counter, he's selling two things. He's selling little bags of this Aurillac, which he sells for the equivalent of 50 pence. And the addicts sniff it from these black bags. And he also sells a synthetic drug, similar to sort of methadone, which they inject. And as you walk along, as you make your way to the counter, you know, I mean, the stuff you see along that corridor is really on the sharp end of sort of utter human misery, really. You're walking on top of used needles. I mean, to be honest, some of the material that we actually filmed down there, we couldn't broadcast.
Now, you said people are living down there, not just going down there to get their drugs. They're living there. So how do they live down there?
Once you get beyond the office, that first sort of drug dealing section, you get back down on your hands and knees, you crawl through another small tunnel, and you get into an area which they call the hostel, which is a larger chamber. And it's all, I mean, it's amazing. They have it all sectioned off. So they've actually managed to bring cement and bricks down there, and they've concreted up individual chambers in this hostel section. And that was the thing that really I found very compelling, was that even in this kind of hellish world, they had tried to make it their own. Mm. So, for example, people had the walls painted pink in sections. There were like family portraits on the wall. They have the internet down there, can you believe? I mean, they've managed to sort of tap in illegally to some of the wiring above ground. They have electricity down there. There's a sound system which is always kind of pumping out this awful sort of trashy Euro dance music. So I described it, you know, in the piece as if they had had a club night in hell, it would feel like that.
And a lot of the people, I believe, are HIV positive or have TB.
practically everybody there is HIV positive, and most, about I think a quarter, have TB. You know, it's, people are in a very bad way. And what was also interesting, again, we'll come to this, but we went back 2 or 3 weeks later, and the people that we had met 3 weeks beforehand, you could really, so you could see the deterioration. It happens really quickly. And one little girl in particular, her name was Catalina, mm-hmm. and she was 17 years of age, and she was in the sort of final throes of she had full-blown AIDS and was in the final throes of her life. And as we filmed her, I remember her saying to us, she talked about this very traumatic life that she had had, and she finished by just looking into the barrel of the camera and saying, you know, but here is where I destroyed myself. And honestly, you could almost see her withering away in front of the camera.
And then she died soon after that, and you went back.
We did, yeah. We got word 2 weeks after that first visit that little Catalina had passed away. We got invited back to her funeral by her family. And that was, as you can imagine, a terribly, terribly sad affair, because you had all of the drug addicts. She was a Roma, a gypsy girl. Mm-hmm. So you had the drug addicts coming up out of the tunnels for her wake. You had her extended Roma family. And then they had this procession through the centre of Bucharest, in the back of a black van, would you believe, that, you know, they couldn't afford a proper hearse or anything like that. So they had a sort of a black high-ace van, basically. They had her little coffin in the back, and this procession walked through the centre of Bucharest, a sort of strange sort of procession of the outsiders across the city.
Now, I get the impression when you spoke initially that these people are lost to society in the sense that they were in these orphanages. And you might help me here. When people were in the orphanages, they were just dumped out onto the street? Is that what happened? Were they sent home to their families? Were they found homes? What happened for most of the people is the first part of that question. And the next thing is, you say that Catalina was repatriated with her family, brought back for the burial. So she did have family. Did she not live down there, or did she just come down and get her drugs, or do you know?
I do know, yeah. I mean, in answer to your first question, I think it's a complicated answer. The impression I get is that the orphanages as an institution sort of, they after the fall of Ceausescu, they just sort of petered out. Now, that said, there are still really interesting projects being run in Romania, and there's a particularly good director of social services, a young woman who is in charge of social services in Bucharest now, has been for the last 7 years, and she's managed to halve the numbers of homeless people living on the street in Bucharest. So there are good people trying to do really good work, and there is some political will in Bucharest to tackle this problem as well. But in the same way with any other city, you'll get the same in Dublin, I bet, is that the problem is that lots of these people, this endemic homelessness, they don't actually want to leave. So, for example, with Catalina, we know that social workers knew she was deteriorating. And 2 days before that little girl died, social workers went down into the tunnels and tried to save her, tried to get her to hospital. And Catalina turned around to them and said, "No, I want to die down here."
Hmm.
So that'll just give you a picture of, you know, in all its twistedness, it gives them a sense of community. It gives them a warm place to sleep. And interestingly, Bruce Lee, even though, of course, he's part of the problem, offers these people protection that they wouldn't necessarily get out on the street.
Now, he's taken some young guy under his wing, I believe.
Yeah, so this is little... Nico, teenager that we met, Nico, who brought us down initially. As the sort of days went on, we started to learn more about that little boy. And as it turned out, he almost died in the same way as Catalina. He almost died last year with diseases related to his full-blown AIDS. But Bruce Lee banned him from using syringes, which ultimately saved his life. And he was put in hospital and was given antiretroviral drugs and made some semblance of recovery. So he's still, thankfully, with us. But the awful catch-22 situation that little boy is in now is that the doctors can't keep giving him the antiretroviral drugs while he's still sniffing that metallic paint. And he's addicted to it, so he can't give it up. So that's the terrible catch-22 situation that young man is in now.
It's horrendous. And do the authorities know they're down there? Presumably, if you knew they were down there, if you went and made two films for Channel 4 about it. They definitely know now. What are they doing about it? Are they going to do anything about it at all?
Well, here's the difficult thing. I mean, on the face of it, most of us would look at a situation like that and say, go in and shut the place down, right? But if they do that, they've made a judgment call, rightly or wrongly, that if they go down and shut the whole place down, these people will scatter out onto the street. They won't be in the contained environment that they are safer in than they would be outside. They're warm. They're relatively protected. So they've made a judgment call in Bucharest. Let's leave well enough alone for the time being. Let's make gentle interventions time by time. Let's monitor them. So that the social services people literally have people monitoring who's going in and who's coming out of that tunnels. And where appropriate, they try to make interventions. Now, whether that's good enough, who knows? But I do have some sort of breaking news for you, if you like, Derek, which just came through in the last hour. I just got word through that Bruce Lee's been arrested. So that will change the dynamic in the tunnels. It'll be interesting to see what happens now.
Well, I wonder, will that be better or worse, given what you're saying, that he's created some kind of semblance of order down there? I mean, you take him out of the equation and the people are still there. Does some other nut job move in and take over who's...
Correct.
I'm going to say not as kind, but I don't know what it's like down there, but you know what I'm saying.
No, that's you've hit the nail on the head.
I mean,
we know that there's another guy waiting for Bruce Lee to vacate his position, shall we say, which he's done. Now, we don't know much about that character, but the sense I get is that the authorities are worried about him.
But they all seem to
step into the void.
Yeah, they all seem to be victims of circumstance. So you said Bruce Lee himself was in an orphanage and he self-harmed. I mean, God knows what happened to him.
I mean, who knows, you know, I mean, he told us a little bit, but the man, he's a proud guy, you know what I mean? He's not going to sort of cry on some Irish journalist's shoulder when I ramble down in there. But we got little glimpses. I mean, we know, for example, that he was abandoned by his family when he was 3 months old, and that he spent, from 3 months old, he was in those Romanian orphanages. And we all remember, don't we, those images of those old orphanages. I remember Ireland being, I remember I was at home at the time, and it made a real sort of cultural impact, those images of those orphanages. So who knows what that guy's been through.
Actually, I remember when I worked on Echo Island with Blondin and Coffee, we had a Beds for Romania campaign.
Well,
we encouraged school children to give 50 pence, as it was at the time, to raise X amount of money to put beds into these orphanages so they'd have proper cots to sleep in. And it made a huge difference to some of the orphanages. And then we had contact with a Romanian orphan who was adopted by an Irish family in Mayo called Brian Menton. I think it's Menton or Menton.
Minton.
And Brian has been in touch with us over the years. We covered his story and he went back and he met his family. And he was one of the lucky ones.
Yeah,
he got out of the orphanage.
Absolutely. And I think it's important to say as well, you know, because of that huge outpouring of generosity and money that came from Ireland and other places at the time, there are success stories. You know, it's not just all, they didn't all just gravitate down into underneath Bucharest. I've been in contact, since my piece has gone out, for example, I've been in contact with a lot of people who are the success stories, which are equally as interesting. But I think what's interesting also about some of the people involved is how kind of cyclical these problems are, so that they've had children of their own and those children become drug addicts and they become sort of strangely institutionalized in their own way, except this time it's underground as opposed to in an orphanage.
How does it affect you, Porrig? You go down to do a story, so you get the real insight. In fact, you say he's not going to cry to you. You're talking about Bruce Lee's not going to cry to some Irish journalist on camera, but actually, ask any journalist with a microphone and a camera and they'll tell you that people tend to tell you stuff they would never tell anybody else, so they tend to open up.
Yeah.
How do you feel when you walk away from it, having heard the stories and seen the people and seen the circumstances they live in?
It's a good question. To be honest with you, and I wish I had a better answer, but it's not something that I think about a lot, because, you know, I consider it just not quite. I don't mean to sound all sort of worthy about this, but I consider it my duty to report on that sort of thing. That said, when you come home after something as intense as that, ask any journalist and you'll know that you have to give yourself some sort of decompression time, as we say, to just sort of, you know, because two nights after being in those tunnels, you know, you're sitting around having a meal with your family. So it's important that you give yourself time to readjust to sort of more normal life. But I'm, to be honest, I guess I was full of admiration for those people, Derek, to be honest, at the end of the day. I mean, even Bruce Lee, I know he's a villain. I know he's a drug dealer. But I'll tell you what else he is, and all of those people down there are. They are the ultimate survivors.
Yeah, I mean, there was a story in a book came out last year about Jews who lived in the sewers during the Nazi occupation of Poland during the Second World War, and they lived down there with the help of some people above ground, and some of them survived the war. And a great book came out last year. We hope to speak to the author, but we didn't get around to it at the time, but we maybe will in time. Listen, you're just back from Albania.
I am.
What were you doing in Albania?
We were looking at, there is a village down in the south of Albania called Lazarat, and up until 3 weeks ago, this little village and the surrounding farms were producing $4.5 billion worth of illegal marijuana. It was a state within a state, basically. 3 weeks ago, the Albanian government moved in with 800 police officers and 400 men from the special forces in Albania to try and shut the operation down. And there was a three-day gun battle. The farmers and the villagers shot mortar rounds at the police.
My goodness, it's a long way from Ballinasloe, Pádraig.
Well, Ballinasloe has its moments too, Derek.
I don't think it's had moments like that in recent history, but maybe you can tell me something different.
Have you ever been to the October Horse Fair?
Well, you know, the very first item we covered on the programme when we started 8 years ago was the Ballinasloe Horse Fair. As that happens, we dispatched, in a good way, Brenda to the horse fair with a friend of mine, Thomas.
It can get quite fruity down in the green on a Saturday night during the October Horse Fair, I can tell you.
How did you end up in the UK? Did you ever work here? Did you work in radio or television here doing news, or did you just go straight to the UK? What happened?
Well, my background is in community development in Ireland. So I worked in community development there. And my first taste of the media was Connemara Community Radio in Letterfrack.
Oh, yeah.
So can I a big shout out to all in Connemara Community Radio. That's where I got the bug for this business.
And then what, you took yourself off to the UK? Is that what happened?
Yeah, I don't want to go into too much details here, but suffice it to say that there was a woman involved.
Yeah.
Found myself in London.
Report part two. Yeah, go on. Yeah, go on.
Found myself in London, yeah, like 17 years ago. Did some community work here, but I've always wanted to be a journalist, so I studied journalism at night time here, and then eventually got a trainee reporter job at the BBC, and that was nearly 10 years ago now.
And how long have you been with Channel 4 News?
Just 2 years.
2 years. Well, I have to say, every time I'm watching ITV or BBC or Channel 4 and I hear an Irish accent, the ears kind of prick up, as they do. You hear somebody, a familiar voice. Terrific reports, harrowing reports, and we have a link on our website, rte.ie/Mooney. Harrowing. But actually, watch them, because you'll be informed after watching them. And continued success, in inverted commas, to yourself, Pádraig, with your work. I know it's not the nicest work in the world, but as they say, somebody's got to do it. But at least you're doing it and making us aware of terrible situations that people live in. Pádraig, thank you very much indeed.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Breed O'Reilly has been on to say, so Derek, nothing changed in Bucharest. I lived there in 1995 for 2 years, tried to work with the kids underground, but it was impossible. Another one from Paul in Cork. Hi Derek, I saw that Channel 4 report from Bucharest. Absolutely surreal. How Pádraig climbed down there is beyond me. It really was a nightmare scenario. Another one here. I worked for 2 summers in a Romanian orphanage in the 90s. I've never forgotten it. Heartbreaking stuff. Daniel O'Donnell did a huge amount
That's
of work.
Right.
He did, yeah, mm-hmm. for the orphanage behind the scenes. I've never forgotten his generosity. Daniel did fantastic work.
Yes, and still does.
A terrific work. Mm-hmm. But he's not the only one.
No.
Okay? Lots of people, and I'm sure Daniel will appreciate this as well, lots of volunteers, people who adopted children from Romania, who've made them the part of their families, loving, caring families, as we heard from Brian. Was it last year, the year before, and then
last
again
year
last
and year?
And
the year before. Yeah.
You know, so lots and lots of people did an awful lot. So, and you did help people. I mean, the important thing is you did. Not everybody ended up down in the sewers. Not everybody, you know. There were thousands upon thousands of people. So you did do a lot to help. And the Irish did an awful lot.